Welcome to the Oldie Literary Lunch, sponsored by Noble Caledonia, the world experts in small ship cruising.
Our final speaker, and a warm welcome back to him. And he's got to suffer my poem again. Our author should make a happy confession. He suffers from biographical obsession. He has catalogued so many famous lives, men and women, husbands and wives. His book tells of one wife who, like a comet, landed on the planet of royalty. Yes, Wallace. Who said Gromit? No! Wallace Simpson, no less, who broke hearts for a living. She caused distress wherever she went, but it caused her pain. And enough. I'm overrunning again. So I, your would-be oldie, Graham Norton, introduce our own Boswell. Welcome back, Andrew Morton.
And welcome to Wallace's restaurant. This is a bit of a Groundhog Day or Groundhog Lunch for me. So where was I when I so rudely interrupted myself? I think I was talking about Meghan Markle and her father not walking her down the aisle. And I think I was offering my arm as a solace. But then I sat down. So... As we all know, it was Prince Charles who did the honours. Two divorcees walking certainly partway down the aisle at St George's Chapel at Windsor Castle. And I don't know about you, but when I listened to the handle as Meghan made her stately, dignified progress down the aisle, I could hear a kind of faint spinning from the distance. And I think it was the Duke and Duchess of Windsor who were buried at Frogmore, furiously spinning in their graves. Why? Well, as you may recall, Edward VIII gave up his throne in 1936 so that he could marry another American, the twice-divorced Wallis Simpson, the lady from Baltimore and the subject of my book. And the issue of divorce, I think, is a thread that binds and divides Meghan, and it's probably fair to say is one of the main themes of the House of Windsor over the last century. When Wallace and Edward wed at a French chateau in June 1937, it was described as the royal romance of the century. And when Charles and Diana married in 1981, ditto. She was and is, I think, a fascinating and rather mysterious woman who has intrigued us ever since she was mentioned in the same breath as the King of England. And I think the question that many people ask is, just what did Edward see in this woman? Rather angular, rather mannish, and somewhat sardonic character. And it's a question I spent several years exploring. And I first became interested in Wallace when I was researching my book on the Duke and Duchess of Windsor and their links to the Nazis and the consequent cover-up, over to you, Miles, about... German documents held by the Americans and the British. I discovered that every time I was talking about Wallace, the narrative became more interesting. Because during the 1930s, Wallace was seen as a saucy blend of Mata Hari and Mae West. The establishment was deeply suspicious of her. She was viewed as a possible Nazi spy, suspected of having an affair with Joachim von Ribbentrop, the German ambassador, and he was said to have given her a carnation for every time they had intimate relations. It tossed up to 17 in the end. Some say it was roses, but I stuck with carnations. And as well as the Prince of Wales, she was said to be having an affair with Guy Trundle, a used car salesman. Apparently, he was a very good dancer. And Queen Mary believed that she was a sorceress who had bewitched her darling David. And then, of course, some people have been... Jeremy, you came up to me and asked about the China dossier, this mythical beast, as it were, that has been knocking around for 80 years or so, but nobody's ever seen it, which seems to suggest that that Wallace was taught in the art of Oriental brothels, and that's how she bewitched and bewildered the king. Effectively, she's learnt how to turn a shilling into a sovereign. But all this rumour and conjecture has surrounded a woman who used to boast that she never let a man go below the Mason-Dixon line, whatever that is. Yet for all the talk of sexual licentiousness, the king always averred that he and Wallace were never lovers before they married. He even sued an author for libel for suggesting such an appalling thing. And in fact, Edward's decision to abdicate for the love of a woman he'd never slept with was the one issue that united Stalin, Mussolini, Hitler, Baldwin, and Roosevelt. They all thought he was bonkers. And it's clear that Edward was utterly besotted. What, though, of Wallace? Well, for a woman whose partner had just given up not just a kingdom, but an empire, she was distinctly unenthusiastic. When he called her from her refuge in the south of France, where she was hiding beneath a blanket, her response was hardly romantic. If he was expecting something on the lines of, "Oh, darling, I love you so much, you've given up so much for our happiness, and we will be happy," or some such tosh, he was sadly disappointed. According to the French secret police, the Sûreté, who were monitoring her phone calls, her response was emphatic. She told him, "You goddamn fool." And as I was to discover during my research, it seems that her true affections lay elsewhere. And I'm indebted to the work of a chap called Cleveland Amory for teasing more insights into the world of Wallace. Because during the 1950s, he was hired as Wallace's ghostwriter. It was a toss-up between him, Ernest Hemingway, I kid you not, and Dame Rebecca West. And he laboured away for 6 months before walking away from the project, saying that Wallace could not be trusted with the truth, rather like some other Americans we could mention. He became an animal rights activist and put his experiences with the Duchess down to experience. And when he died, he left his papers to Boston Public Library. They were stored in a warehouse at the edge of the city, and so I found myself on a freezing cold February day rummaging through 166 boxes, about that wall filled with animal rights pamphlets, books, not a sniff of Wallace. And after about 4 hours and no joy, the words of Cleveland's daughter saying that he'd lost all his royal notes came back to haunt me. But I was just about to give up and thought I was on a fool's errand. And I came to a folder that said, "Picture of man, woman, child." Well, I opened it up, and inside was a picture of George VI, Queen Elizabeth, and Princess Elizabeth. And the woman who'd annotated it was an animal rights activist. She had no clue who these people were. So from then on, it was like finding an Aladdin's cave, pictures of the king in a pair of shorts, Wallace in bathing costume, even a description of an interview that Cleveland had undertaken with the Queen at Windsor Castle. He found her a lot less formal than Wallace in her fastness in the south of France. So these Manila folders yielded the biographical equivalent to an Aladdin's cave of information. And most intriguing were the interviews and letters with a chap called Herman Rogers. Now, Herman and his wife, Catherine, they had hosted Wallace in Peking during her year of living in China, not visiting as many brothels as suggested in the China dossier. And they had entertained her in a villa in the south of France and also given her a home during the abdication crisis. And because of death threats to Wallace, Herman slept next door to her bedroom with a loaded revolver by his bedside. In fact, he slept in the adjoining room much longer than was strictly necessary. And in many ways, he was more of a husband to Wallace than Edward ever was, choosing the wedding venue, dealing with the quotidian details of her life. And I've always suspected that there was something more between Herman and Wallace, and the letters and notes in Amory's long-forgotten boxes suggested as much. In a cryptic and tantalisingly inconclusive note, Amory jotted down the fact that just a few days before the wedding, Wallace told Herman that she was in love with him, that she was prepared to have his baby, and that if she became pregnant, it would be passed off as the Duke's. Of course, nothing happened, and at 41, she was the wrong end of the childbearing years. But it was an intriguing, though, as I say, inconclusive episode. Perhaps more significant was at Herman's second wedding to a woman called Lucy Wan in the 1950s. Wallace did her best to scupper their relationship and Lucy's wedding day. This is a bit of the old green eye, the jealousy about Herman. She thought that he was her property. And at one point, Wallace took Lucy aside and told her, "Herman is the only man I've ever loved." Now, this is, remember, what the king had done. He'd abdicated. And Lucy let those words sink in, and she replied, "I'm sure the Duke will be thrilled." So much for the royal romance of the century. Ultimately, the union of Wallace and Edward was defined by a sense of disappointment and disenchantment, at least from Wallace's side. And for me, the most poignant interview that I conducted during several years of interviews with various people was with a nurse called Julie Chottard Alexander. And as fate would have it, she lived just a few miles away from where Wallace was schooled in Baltimore. She cared for the Duke in his final days and remembered that most nights he would call for his wife like a lamb calling for his mother, calling out, "Wallace, Wallace, Wallace, Wallace." But she never came to his bedside. And in May 1972, he died in Julie's arms. And as she said, "Right city, wrong woman." The Duchess outlived the Duke by 13 years, and there is an irony in the fact that she's buried at Frogmore, next to a man she barely tolerated in the private cemetery of a family she loathed and under the earth of a country that she despised. And one hopes that the latest American addition to the royal family has better luck and greater happiness. Thank you.
For more about the Oldie magazine and Amber Lunches, go to theoldie.co.uk.